Hello, I'm Jennifer Braverman, and welcome to Stories from the Earth. Today, I am doing this solo. Ellen is still spending time with her new baby. And if you're watching this on YouTube or Spotify, you'll notice it is very dark. It's late at night. So, when I'm recording this, welcome to episode 44. This is a best of episode. I took clips from all across our two, I guess, almost 3 years of this podcast. And if you find that after you listen to the clips, you're like, I want to listen to the rest of the episode, I'll put the links in the descriptions to the full episodes. Some of the older episodes are a little unedited because I wasn't editing at that point. So they're a little, I guess, a little rougher than the newer clips. So just keep that in mind. So Stories from the Earth is a podcast where we explore humankind's relationship and connection to the natural world. I'm going to do some intros of a few groups of clips and play the clips, and then do the next group of clips and play the clips. Just sort of the format like the last best of. And if you like this one, I'll also put the link to the best of volume one in the description. I want to just say that I want to thank everybody for sort of bearing with us during sort of this transitional time with Alan away, and my life has been a bit crazy, so we haven't gotten our two podcasts out a month. It's just more like one. Although I'm really, really, really happy with our last panel. So if you didn't catch the last episode, please do. It's amazing. It's about the change of seasons of fall and winter, which we are fast approaching winter now, but we are definitely solidly in fall. It's amazing and gorgeous here in the mountains. I think it's like the most beautiful fall I've ever seen. So me and Ellen also recently had a big planning session for this coming year, and I'm pretty excited. We've got some really cool guests we want to bring on for interviews and books we want to do, and a lot of other stuff that like I really, really want to make happen. And I also want to say that we really appreciate everyone who's followed the podcast and supported us. And we just want to shout out to all our awesome listeners. And so thank you very much. We love you guys. We're planning something special for our 50th episode, which is really soon. We're about 5-ish episodes away from that. So, okay, so let's get into it with our first batch of clips. Okay, so the first clip is of our previous episode, which is which was about fall and winter. Yeah, so it's Sarah Jackson talking about this idea of four seasons of relentless change, which is an idea that I have never even thought about. And it's so cool. So this is it's a good sized chunk. And yeah, so that's gonna be our first clip. The next one is Lori Jenkins. She's talking about her herbal education, and I think a little bit about how she got into herbalism. Lori has a business called Sister of Mother Earth. And I always love asking herbalists how they get their start and their education because it's always really fascinating for me. The next clip is of Patricia Howell, and she runs the herb school called Botanologos. We're always talking about the good, awesome parts about being an herbalist. But we asked her what might be a hard part about being a herbalist. So this is her answer from that episode. And then the next clip is also of her talking about her herb school. So if you're interested in her herb school, I would definitely listen to this clip and check out the herb school. The link is in the description of that episode. If you're in around the North Georgia area, or where I am, it's only like an hour and a half away in North Carolina. I'm in North Carolina, so it's an easy drive. It's a really neat school, and I'm partial because I went. So shout out, she's a really awesome teacher. So the next clip is quite a long one. We interviewed Jordan Hughes. She's a massage therapist. And she does, she was doing herbal bath boxes, like ritual baths, which are really cool. And I hope she'll pick that up because they were really awesome. But, and she does these beautiful, like, botanical drawings. So we asked her why you wanted to learn massage. And this is her answer. This is one of the older ones. This is from episode 18. As we know, some places on our planet, they don't have four seasons. Sometimes they have two. Sometimes maybe they have zero. How do you think this affects the idea of change in the lives of the people there? And do you think they have other ways of connecting to the idea of change?
As someone who thinks a lot about all of this kind of stuff, at least the nature aspect, that like kind of perspective from a naturalist here, and also as someone who's not really well traveled, I have not ever really had the opportunity to, you know, travel around the world like my imagination takes me all the time. But I love studying different places on the planet and, you know, indigenous cultures, all of that kind of stuff. That's just something I absolutely can just track of time for like forever and not come back if I don't make myself. But I recently was watching this fantastic show, despite being by an older white fellow. He is one of my favorite older white fellows. That's David Attenborough. He's a credit to the human species in my humble opinion, but he did this series, Green Planet. The Green Planet is his newest one, and it is all right. From a completely botanical perspective. And, you know, there's not a lot of plants that we have around here, but, you know, I can use my imagination to know, you know, if this happened somewhere else, this is likely what happens in our forest. You know, like plants track the sun. You know, they use all of this amazing technology and photography to show us in live, real, and even sped up time what the plants do. One of my favorite quotes, I think he said from the series, he was, you know, you have places in the world that can change a whole awful lot. And then you have the temperate zone, which we're in, and it's four seasons of relentless change. It's just it never not changes. And so you have these places in the world that are quite extreme. You know, you have the polar, you have the poles, you know, you have land of the midnight sun and the aurora borealis and the aurora australis, these things that can only happen, you know, on that parallel in that region. And then you have the equator, and, you know, for them it's mostly a factor of wet and dry. You know, it may not change because they're equatorial, but, you know, what does change for them is the monsoon season, dry season. And it's pretty amazing to discover through technology, of all things, of course, all these incredibly interwoven patterns and things that happen in the world. For instance, you know, the great storm in Africa sweep up this nutrient, mineral-rich soil and take it across the ocean and dump it as rain onto the Amazon rainforest. And, you know, even though they don't have seasons like we do, you know, they're the lungs of the earth. They can't just kind of like stop and take a break. They're the earth's life support, quite literally, thinking about the context of, you know, four seasons of relentless change. We're kind of special in that way, this temperate zone of the planet. Like I said, I'm not well traveled, so I don't really know like so many of the stories and the cultures personally, just from, you know, what I've been able to imagine and read and learn and study for a really long time. But, you know, adapting, I feel like, is something that we have to do very well. You know, obviously everybody has to do it very well, but certainly a special kind of adaptation for us in a land of relentless change for completely different seasons. All the life around us is having to make immediate use of, you know, their energy stores, their food stores, foraging, all of that. So, I mean, maybe if I were to propose one way to get in touch with nature during any of the seasons, it would just be to, I mean, not necessarily forage. Some people don't have access to amazing places to forage, and some people, you know, may need to find a community or, you know, someone to learn from. But, you know, even if you don't actually consume the thing, you could forage by, you know, like keeping a nature journal. I guess the one thing that's most prevalent to me is the change, and watching all of my favorite trees and plants and animals through each season. You know, because everything that lives in this area kind of has a distinct one, more or less, maybe minus humans, more or less. I feel like human nature in general kind of feels like we're too good to be a part of that. In some ways, you know, it's like, we have to remove ourselves from nature and the seasons. You know, we have to extend our light and, you know, travel all around, you know, like not be bioregional and, you know, things like that. I would love to leave it to all of these other amazing women to fill in the blank when it comes to how that affects the people that live there. But those are like my thoughts when it comes to different places in the world, extremes.
What was your herbal education like, and why, like, did you decide that you wanted to pursue this path?
Over a decade ago, I just kept getting promptings that we needed to really work on being able to manage our health on our own. I know that sounds a little extreme, but I just had these nudges, you know, start growing your own food, start growing your own herbs, do these things. And we were big time, like, library people. I was homeschooling my kids. And but I had a friend say something to me about a conference that was going on every year in Black Mountain. And that was Wise Woman. And that first year that I found out about it, I wasn't able to go. But after that, I went for years. And then I started taking my daughter, who, when she got a little older, and that's where I started meeting people. I met Asia Suler, I met Becky Bayer, Julia Blankenspor. I just, you know, had all these people that I admired and loved taking classes from them. So that's kind of where I jumped off from.
Yeah, and that's the Southeast Women's Herbal Conference. It's in Black Mountain. It's every year. This year is a strange year because of COVID, but I have attended two of them, and they're just a really fantastic way to, like, be introduced to, like, this herbal thing. And it's very, like, friendly, open. There's a lot of classes you can just sort of dip your toe in. I took a fantastic class with Juliet, and it's just like, I was like, whoa, I learned like so much in like a tiny span of time. So
sad right now, it's not going on right now. I don't really know what's gonna happen with the conference, but there are others in the country. I would love to go to the Northeast one. But, you know, that's kind of where it started. And then I took the Chestnut School of Herbal Medicine. I did their foraging course a couple of years ago, the first year that it came out. And that's where the business kind of really started. And I just kind of moved forward with that. And that same year, I took Asia Suler's plant intuitive medicine class. And that was really, really good, her course. Mm-hmm. And I think that's still going. Now, I think you can actually sign up all the time now for that one. At that time, you could only do it during one, you know, time of the year. So both of those were just really, it just made me focus more on what I wanted to do. You know, yeah. I wanted to focus more on food and herbal food and that being my medicine.
Because you know, herbs can be used as food in like a huge way. That's a huge component of how you can actually take your herbs. And it all ties into like the health stuff. And it's just, you know, there's a real close connection. So, I'll post those links if anyone's interested in any of those courses, because I believe at least Juliet School, the Chestnut School, is all online now.
Right.
And I'm assuming Asia's is online as well.
It is.
And they're both really good places to start your journey. Mm-hmm. And I think also right now during COVID, all the herb schools are online. So, you know, start now. And then later on when we can have in person, find your in-person class and go for it. I would say that would be a great thing. So, well, that's awesome. That's a great way. That was a great introduction. Mm-hmm. You know, we have so much fabulous resources here in our area. Yeah, I want to go to more herbal conferences too. So maybe one day. And that could be like another thing for this podcast. I would definitely love to just, anyway, I'm going off topic, but herbal conferences are really great. And I would advise anyone who's interested to grab your closest herbal conference. And there's a bunch. There just seems to be more popping up.
Sometimes I do feel frustrated by, you know, even this is even pre-COVID, you know, in order to support yourself doing this work, you have to be very creative. And I feel like I spend way too much time sitting at a desk preparing lectures. You know, I mean, I have a great assistant who works for me, who does all the financial billing and things like that. But just all the planning that goes into teaching sometimes really drags me down. I am like hopeful that I'm going to win a lottery ticket or something. Of course, I would probably have to buy the ticket in order for that to be the case, which I have not done yet. Yeah. I mean, if I had independent means and somebody was supporting me financially, I probably would either hire somebody to do all those things or not do them at all.
I also wish it was a little easier to be an herbalist, especially from the financial standpoint. I wish I could just, you know, pop into college and learn herbalism and practice.
More meaning in our society in that sense.
Yeah, that, I mean, and that's it exactly what you're saying, Ellen, is that, you know, if somebody goes to school to be an RN, they're guaranteed kind of a certain amount of income. You know, it's like, it's a job, you can go get it somewhere, you know, but when you finish herb school, you're still on your own. You know, it's like, there's no place to go apply for a job, or even if you decided, I want to see clients and help people, how do you even let people know that you exist? It's a slow, slow process.
Yeah. That requires, like you said, a lot of constant creativity to produce what you got to do to keep it rolling. I mean, that's entrepreneurship in general, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's kind of almost like a poster child for entrepreneurism is being an herbalist.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about the school. And did you ever think that you were going to become a teacher? Like what's a favorite thing about being a teacher?
Ah, okay. Well, that's a good one. Well, you know, when I was in college, if I had to like read a paper that I wrote or stand up in front of the class, I was just a mess. You know, I was just like, oh my God, you know, people are looking at me. You know, I would be tongue-tied and sweating and a mess. But when I started talking to people about herbs, it was almost like all that disappeared. I was like, I don't have time for that. I need to tell these people about plants. This is so important. And one of the things that I marvel at is that I have absolutely no anxiety about doing that, about talking in front of groups of people, because I just feel like that's my job, is to connect these people with these plants and make that connection happen. That really takes away anything that would be fear-inducing or anxiety-producing for me. Okay, so that's kind of how I became a teacher, is because I really just wanted to get people excited about plants. But when Althea and I split the business, I was living in Atlanta. We would take our students to the mountains like 2 weekends out of the program to look at plants. So I decided to move to the mountains and let the students, because I felt like I'd been in Atlanta for 5 years, and I felt like people would follow me. That was my plan, was to get a little bit of a reputation. And, you know, I kind of chose Georgia because of the Southern Appalachians, and because in 1992, 93, there were absolutely nobody teaching herb classes anywhere to be found. You know, I did I checked Asheville, I checked all these places. It was like nothing. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go take Georgia. So when Althea and I split the school, I think a year later, I moved to the mountains and moved the school and then changed it. We used to be called Living with Herbs Institute. And then I changed it to Botanologos, which is the word in Greek that means somebody who knows about plants. So that's where that name comes from. Just one program to begin with, and now it's expanded with a lot of other teachers. We have people coming who do plant walks, people who do just standalone workshops, medicine making classes, all under the umbrella of the school.
The thing that really got me interested in massage was the first time I received a massage, I was stunned. Not only, like, I was really surprised about how instantly better my muscles felt. Like, I had a lot of injuries that doctors had seen me for, and even had like traditional therapies for the injuries. They didn't touch the pain at all. And a massage therapist was like, oh, it's actually here instead. And I got a massage and I didn't have the problem anymore. That, and then being able to actually, because with the childhood trauma that I experienced, I have what's called CPTSD. So it's complex post-traumatic stress disorder. Well, massage therapy, that first massage that I got, was able to put me in my body and make me feel safe in my body. And that was really nice to feel my nervous system be like, okay, everything's fine. Like, let's relax and take a deep breath.
So. Kind of like grounding and being like, oh, here you are.
Yeah.
What? It gave
it's
you
like,
a,
oh, my body.
Well, it gave you a safe, you felt safe.
Yeah.
And instead of trying to run. So yeah, you know, like, or hide or something like that. Like, and
yeah, it got me into rest and digest state. And I was like, oh, this is nice. You can actually rest. So yeah, that experience was so amazing. I was like, I want to do this for other people. Like, I want to be able to give someone a massage and help their muscles feel better. And like, people in a lot of ways don't even realize that a massage can do that. So it really, receiving that massage made me an advocate. And I was like, I definitely want to be able to do this for people in their lives, because I feel like it's such a valuable tool to be able to help someone's muscles and their nervous system relax at the same time.
And I think a lot of people don't realize it, but with massage, you know, it's not just the physical that you're like getting release from, you know, like, you hold emotions in your muscles and in your body. And I think people don't even realize it, because we put very little emphasis on the body.
Yeah.
In our culture. And so that's where I found value for me in massage is, you know, I have some physical things going on, but mostly it's emotional stuff manifesting on physical level. That's been very, very helpful.
It kind of helps to show in a very grounded, direct way how much everything's connected, you know?
Yeah, it definitely is surprising. Like, I still have clients, like, we just aren't taught that as a culture. And the clients are always surprised when that happens. Like, if something comes up, they're like, oh, I got really anxious, or I had a feeling of like sadness. And it's like, yeah, that can actually happen, because when you feel an emotion, your muscles, they move and they kind of hold it because they're expecting an action to come from that feeling. Granted, in society, in our day and age, there's not actions that come from the feelings. So then the muscles hold on to the feelings and the actions, and they kind of get stuck in that, especially if it's a feeling and an action that's continuously like repeated. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I mean, we're taught that our feelings are BS, that they don't mean anything, but they do. They do. In fact, they're even, I don't know if they're more important, but they are at least as equally important as our thoughts. And a lot of times you'll have the feeling before the thought, you know, you'll feel a certain way. And so you just really can't discount them. And I think some illness comes from that, you know, just holding all that in, like you said, it's just, you know, you gotta let it out.
Yeah, that is for sure. And two, in massage school, it was just so surprising. Part of massage school was getting massages almost every day from our classmates. And it was very interesting seeing the stuff that would come up for people in class, because in massage school, since we're all massage therapists, there's a little bit more space to talk about what comes up emotionally, because in a massage practice setting, you have to be really careful to make sure that the client, because there is a power differential when you're a massage therapist and someone is a client, sometimes the client can look up to you, and you have to be really careful about making sure that you're not therapizing them or like giving them therapy.
Legality concerns.
Yeah. Well, legality, and also there's just some stuff that I cannot deep dive in with people because they don't have the skills or tools. And so with massage school, it was really interesting because since we were all on the same level of like knowing, I guess knowing about the power differential and stuff, we were able to talk about the stuff that was coming up. So it was interesting to see how it was affecting people. It was really interesting. It would be crazy because I noticed when people would work on my neck, I would have anxiety a lot of the times, and it turned out it was kind of connecting to a car wreck that I'd had, and that same anxiety would come up anytime someone would try to work in that area where there was tightness.
Your body had held on to that trauma.
Yeah.
The next clip is from another Lori who's an herbalist, and we asked her what advice she would give to herbalists or beginner farmers. She does farming, and she's an herb grower mainly. And she has a really, really cool relationship with her herbs and her plants. So the next one is from an astrologer interviewed. Her name is Molly, and she also works with herbs in relation to astrology, we thought was really cool. And this is about her training and how she got her training. So the first clip is by is from our interview by Kaylin Otto. They do a amazing travel like blog, they have a podcast, they wrote an awesome book about travel. And so this is a question about what is travel and what does it do? The next one is about what inspires them about the natural world. So that's always a favorite question of ours to ask. The next one is a book chat. We did the book Biophilia. And this is from our intro. So it talks about what the book is and I guess a little bit about the book. It's a little long clip, but I thought it was really interesting when I was going back through and looking at the clips. And the book is a little bizarre, but it's really cool. And it's got some really, really neat ideas in it. Some of the book I did find a little hard to stay with because it was a little slow, but I still would definitely recommend this book and definitely check out the episode if you're interested. And I also have some clips up on the YouTube channel. So for some of the best bits, I feel like really, really talk about like the author really talks about this idea of humans living in space, which is something that like we don't think about like at all, like not in any kind of, I feel like, real sense.
So, like, what advice would you give to budding fellow plant nerds, herbalists, ecologists, permaculturists, farmers, and so forth? Like, from your years of experience and whatnot, what do you, someone who came to you new trying to learn today, like,
start small. Don't spend more than you can afford to lose. I mean, that's like the most important thing. Ask a lot of questions, find people to ask questions of. Don't be afraid to make mistakes. One of the things that I do here is I show people my mistakes. There's a way that I learned to make ginseng that was hard. It was a hassle and it cost more than anything else. Least productive way to grow ginseng, but I have the stuff to show people. Let me save you time and energy. This is what you might be told. Don't do it. You're going to make mistakes. You can't help it. Diversify. Don't deal with things that are dangerous. You know, with the plant world, you know, mints, calendula, tulsi. I mean, there's so many easy things to start with that there's always people who want them. Even if you just grow a little bit, there's nothing like having tea from your own plant. I remember my first cup of tea from my own plants that I did consciously. I was probably 10 years old and nothing tasted better. It was really cool. My grandmother was so proud of me, you know. I was so proud of me. It was great. You know, I spent years living in apartments and stuff. And I always just, like I said, didn't realize I was doing it. But I always had dirt. Dirt's so good. Soil, I should say. Soil, not dirt. Find some customers. You know, there's a big world online. Or on Facebook, there's groups where you can swap and barter. I've gotten some great handmade soaps. I don't make soap. It's not something I've gotten into yet. And I don't use commercial soap, so I've gotten soaps for products, you know. Find a mentor. Find somebody you can ask questions.
What has your training been like for both astrology and herbalism?
Yeah, with astrology, I definitely started out mostly how like a lot of people start out, just reading a lot of books and doing a lot of self-study. I was lucky, though, to find a lot of older mentors in the field. It's actually kind of a signature in my chart. I have Saturn conjunct my north node, and there's kind of this saying around that where there's a lot of older kind of people to help you on your path. So I have felt that effect. One of the astrologers I really enjoy, his name's Gemini Brett, and he's also like a friend, and he does a lot of astronomy for astrologers. So he's all into like renaturing astrology. And so I very much resonated with him. And I also have done some peer groups with OPA, which is the Organization for Professional Astrology, which is like a pretty more recent organization, but they're trying to really create some sort of, like they do peer groups where you meet with other astrologers and you assess a chart together and get feedback on your reading styles. And they're open to like different branches of astrology, but I would say it's predominantly like more Western astrology based. So I've done some peer groups with them. And right now I'm about to start like a horary astrology formal course because I'm trying to get more of that like traditional backgrounds like kind of drilled into me. Because even though horary astrology is used for answering a question, you can really use it by practicing it in that context of like answering questions. You're really learning, like it's like practicing the basic arithmetic of astrology, because mm-hmm. you have to know all the essential dignities, like which planets are at their strength in certain signs and which planets are weak. And so that just naturally carries over into being able to like bring those skills into a natal chart reading. In terms of herbalism, I've studied with my teacher, Seja Popham, and he is with the School of Evolutionary Herbalism. And he's one of the few people, there's like more than a few, but the handful of people who teach like alchemical herbalism, astro herbalism. Mm-hmm. So I did his astro herbalism program, and that was amazing. And that's really connecting medical astrology with understanding how to determine like planetary rulers of certain plants and looking at those signatures and creating those connections. And then I've also studied a more medical astrologer is Judith Hill, and she's actually Seja's teacher as well, but she's a pretty well-known medical astrologer, and she's got programs and books on medical astrology. I highly recommend her books. So that's kind of my background. I would say it's definitely, it's always growing though. I'm always learning.
I'd like to just talk a minute about travel in general. I was wondering, in your experience, what does it mean to travel, and what does the act of travel do? And I guess, how does it change a person to travel or not change a person to travel?
Yeah. So first thing that comes to mind actually about not changing a person to travel, I think that, you know, we see pictures of people traveling and we hear about these incredible adventures and we think, oh my gosh, travel will change me completely. And in some ways it will. Like your whole world has changed. You've expanded your mind. You can't come back to what it was before. You've seen all these things, you've experienced all these things, but at the same time, like at your core, you're still the same person. What is travel? I think it's just going out of our comfort zone. Like traveling is even going on a hike on the weekend to a new place you haven't been to before, right? Just that adventure of traveling, going somewhere else, moving to a new place you haven't been to before is travel for me. And so, yeah, once you're in a new place, like you're forever changed. Every second you're forever changed. Just other people and interacting with the earth changes you in some way. But, you know, people seem to think that once you travel, like, you won't be depressed anymore. All your problems will be solved. You'll know what you're here on this earth to do. All these big things. And it's like, no, you're still there. You take those things with you. You might have some space away from them to reflect on them and see what changes you want to make in your life, and you're growing and expanding. But at the end of the day, you're still you, just in a new place. So I guess the act of travel is just taking yourself somewhere new and allowing that to incorporate, you know, into your life, whatever changes has happened. But that is one myth about travel that I like to dispel. Because at the end of the day, you're just you in a new place. So you change, and at the same time, you don't change. You're still the same person.
So Kaylin, what inspires you most about the natural world? We always like to ask her. Guess that as it ties into our theme.
Probably how unruly it is. Like the trees are doing what they want. The other animals that we share this planet with are doing what they want. They're not like asking for permission. They're not like, oh, how much money do you have? Oh, how tall? You know what I mean? Like, look at, they're just not doing these things that I feel like we as humans have set up these rules for ourselves. We've created these boxes, or other people have created these boxes. Now we're all expected to fit into them. And if we don't, you're like punished for it. And the natural world, they're just there. Like I always think of, you know, body things too, having experienced different body issues and disordered eating and stuff like that. I never really realized it until my partner kind of pointed out to me, but like we love curves in nature. we love when trees like twist and are curvy and have all these different shapes and sizes. Like, we adore that in nature, and then we punish humans for that. And I just think we forget that, like, we are nature. We're the same thing. So I love how nature is just doing what they're doing, and they're not apologizing for it. Like, it's just there. And I think that, you know, the biggest thing for us is learning, like, how do we get back to that too? All these things we appreciate in nature.
Get back to it. Hello, humans.
Hello.
Welcome to your once in future life.
Yes. Because we're there. We're like in nature, right? We have all we've ever had is nature. Everything we have is built from it. So, yeah, how do we get back to like just being a part of nature and not apologizing for that and kind of breaking down all these things that we created that the natural world is just doing and being, I guess.
Today we're going to be doing a book review episode on Biophilia by Edward O. Wilson. I learned of this book from my sister, who's a biologist and works in conservation. And she knows that I've always had a fascination with ants, and E.O. Wilson here, his specialty is entomology, particularly with regards to study of ants. But this book is not his main ant book. This book is considered his most personal work, and it's more of a reflection on what he feels to be the important and intrinsic connection that humans have to the natural world and why it is important that we realize such. For the overview of the book and why he wrote it, I think it's pretty well addressed in his own words, so I'll share the prologue here with you. He says, "On March 12, 1961, I stood in the Arawak village of Bernhardstorp and looked south across the white sand coastal forest of Suriname. For reasons that were to take me 20 years to understand, that moment was fixed with uncommon urgency in my memory. The emotions I felt were to grow more poignant at each remembrance, and in the end, they changed into rational conjectures about matters that had only a distant bearing on the original event. The object of the reflection can be summarized by a single word, biophilia, which I will be so bold as to define as the innate tendency to focus on life and lifelike processes. Let me explain it briefly here and develop the larger theme throughout the book. From infancy, we concentrate happily on ourselves and other organisms. We learn to distinguish life from the inanimate and move towards it like moths to a porch light. Novelty and diversity are particularly esteemed. The mere mention of the word extraterrestrial evokes reveries about still unexplored life, dispatching the old and once potent exotic that drew earlier generations to the remote islands and jungled interiors. That much is immediately clear, but a great deal more needs to be added. I will make the case that to explore and affiliate with life is a deep and complicated process in mental development. To an extent still undervalued in philosophy and religion, our existence depends on this propensity, our spirit is woven from it, and hope rises on its currents. There's more. Modern biology has produced a genuinely new way of looking at the world that is incidentally congenial to the inner direction of biophilia. In other words, instinct is in this rare instance aligned with reason. The conclusion I draw is optimistic. To the degree that we come to understand other organisms, we will place a greater value on them and on ourselves." So I thought that was a really nice lead in, because people be like, what does biophilia even mean? I mean, I had never heard the word until I learned of this book, for one.
Yeah, it's not something that I was familiar with. So I think it's just not a word that's widely talked about, or maybe it's more talked about in like more scientific circles, because I have never heard of this book before now. And I can't say I know too many scientists, so.
I feel like a few times in the book, kind of, I don't know, he doesn't really say it super directly, but he's more or less getting at the point that he very purposefully chose that name for this book, because he had sort of a somewhat poetic view of the word but that's grounded in the science of his conservation work and his biology and all of that. It's like he must have been searching for the perfect word to describe this feeling he thought was innate in humans, and then it was like, aha, you know, the light bulb went off or something.
Yeah, because that was my question, like, did he invent this word for this book? And now I'm like, oh, I gotta look up what the word means on the, you know, on the internet right now. But I was just thinking, because some authors will do that, they'll invent a word, but when you're talking about a word that invokes a feeling, a lot of times people will mention, oh, there's this word in French that is not in English, but it has this feeling.
Yeah.
And it's nice to know that maybe there are some English words that also do the same thing. So that's cool.
This next clip, we interviewed storyteller Doug Elliott, and he is talking about how stories are, how we make sense of our lives. He does some harmonica in the interview. He sings and tells a bunch of stories, and it's really cool. So this next clip is from our interview with the ladies behind Of Wand and Earth. They're a store in Marshall, North Carolina. And it's what inspires you about the natural world. We have two clips where we interviewed Mason from Herb Rally, which is an awesome website. Please check it out. And this is how he knew that this like herbal path was right for him. And then the second clip from Mason is about his herbal education. Our last clip is from episode 6. So it's a much older episode. I interviewed Sierra Foley. This episode I recommend everyone listen to. It's not edited, so it is a little rough around the edges, but Sierra runs an herb school in Asheville, North Carolina. And this interview is like 2 hours of like some really cool chat about herbs and about herbalism and about health. So this is How Did You Get Into Herbalism? And I've been wanting to put one of her clips up for a long time. So that is our last clip.
What role and importance do you feel that storytelling has? Not even just like because it's been your line of work, but like culturally and for humanity and for our relationships with nature in the grand scheme.
Well, stories is how we make sense of a lot of what's going on in life. You know, I ask you what you did today, and you'll tell me a story. You'll tell me a narrative, and that's basically how we make sense of our life. And there's places in our brain that are hooked for stories. You can deliver information to somebody, and it's one thing, but you tell a story, they really will stick.
I find it's like easier to learn, even just like if somebody tells me a string of facts. Kind of not gonna, it's gonna go everywhere, but if you can connect it up with a story, and even like a partial story about something, then you can really remember it and grasp it. So.
Absolutely. I remember hearing this storyteller telling traditional African stories, and she said, you know, I went on a bicycle trip one time across Uganda. I'm like, boing, my interest went right, much, I listened much better to that story when I heard her telling her personal story.
Makes it come alive. It's funny, I was literally right before getting on here, I was talking to my husband. We're expecting our first kid, and I've been collecting books and stories and things because that was always so important to me as a kid to read and have stories read to me. And so I've been building this like child library, and we were having this discussion about like age appropriateness for text, and not so much in terms of like, you know, because people don't give kids enough credit for how smart they really can be and what they can absorb, right? But my argument was just that like it's not so much about what information is being presented, it's how it's being presented, because, you know, kids respond so well to story. It's like it has to be engaging, it has to be something that's going to spark wonderment. But I say that about kids, but I think it's true for adults too. You know, it's like you get hooked in if there's something that like gets the gleam in the eye and encourages the curiosity, right?
Right. My dad was a pretty good storyteller. And my mom would tell the story about, we'd do whatever activity we were doing when me and my brother were toddlers, our little kids. And we'd do some activity during the day. And then he'd come home from work, and she'd tell him what we did. And then at bedtime, he'd tell a story about the little boy who lived in Round Bay, and you know, which is where it was the name of the community we lived in. And he just would tell the story and to tell basically whatever she told him. And it was like a way of reliving it, and it was totally engaging. I tried that with my child, and that really worked really well. Just changed the name a little bit, you know, and just made it a little different. And then I'd add things to it, you know, and well, he went out into the garden and he dug sweet potatoes, and then along came a raccoon, and next thing you know, and that was a great way to have a bedtime story, you know. And I also found, like, especially you all being new parents, sometimes the kid just screaming and crying and just absolutely unconsolable. And I'd say, you know what? I saw this little dog, and he was chased by a pony, and just start this little narrative going. And it's amazing how that would pull them out of a tantrum.
So suddenly they're like hooked, like, wait a minute, I want to know what about this.
Yeah, I scream, I'm not going to be able to hear the story. So, you know, just keep that in mind. You may need that one day.
Yeah, I think I actually vaguely recall, because I'm the oldest of three. And I remember one time as kids where I diffused my two younger sisters arguing by just launching into some silly made up thing, you know, because then it's like, well, how could you keep arguing if you're just going to be laughing at this silly story, you know?
All right, there you go.
I have a cat visitor. This is Eugene.
Hello, Eugene.
We have this great photograph of my little brother sitting on my dad's lap, and my dad's like, he's got this hand on his face, like exasperated because he's read my brother this story over and over again for like the millionth time. And he just like would listen, just read it again. He couldn't get enough. So it's just really, really funny. So prepare for that too, Ellen.
Yeah. I have all these CDs, and now and then one of the parents will say, yeah, we had to lose that TV, that CD. Couldn't find it for 2 months. Then it revives again, and the kid may be onto something else. When something resonates, it really resonates, you know. I always kind of remember resistant to try to tell a story, the same story twice to a group. But a lot of people say, no, we want to hear it, you know.
What inspires you most about the natural world?
The thing that inspires me the most about the natural world is the way that the natural world creates puzzles and pictures and connections for me to, I don't know, it speaks. I feel like when I'm there and I'm in nature, and I live in the woods, live in the forest, on the river, and I feel like it's for me. Like that moment is for me. That animal, you know, the crows that are talking, or, you know, right there, they're for me. They're communicating, they're keeping me safe, they're letting me know what I need to know, they're guarding over my family. And that may not be the truth, but that's sure how it feels to me when I'm there. When I'm in the water, I don't know, it's the most powerful, beautiful, pure feeling to be near that beautiful water and be in those old trees and the mushrooms and the animals and everything. I mean, it's just, you feel alive, you know, and I feel like I have the ability to keep doing, you know, the hard work because this is what it's for. And I feel like part of my work is advocating for nature and advocating for the water, advocating for the trees and the animals, you know, to do my best and do right by them so they can have balanced life too. I don't know. To me, that's life. That's real.
Well, for me, what inspires me about nature is how it can ground and center you so quickly. And like people always ask me, like, how I was even asked that yesterday, how do I get in a better place or a better frame of mind? And I'll always say, go walk outside barefoot. And it just, it has the power to, you know, make everything else seem so inconsequential, you know, everything sort of falls away. And for people that are overwhelmed with life, I'm always telling them just get outside, you know, as much as you can. Like even growing up in New York, I mean, I grew up in Washington Square Park, you know, and that has like little patches of grass and trees. And I was forever there as a kid. And then obviously Central Park too, just because nature was always really important. And what I find really interesting too about the mountains around here, like I've never experienced this and I've lived in quite a few places, but like when I leave, it feels like when I come back and that first glimpse of the mountain, it's like I can breathe again. And I'm not even aware, like I've been holding my breath, I've been, you know, out of sorts or anything, but that first glimpse of the mountains, it's like them saying, welcome back, where have you been? And, but then I feel myself like, and I do that breathing thing, and it surprises me because it happens every single time, no matter where I go. And that's really powerful.
There was a second part to that question. How did I know the...
How do you know it was just kind of the right thing for you that you were going to turn this into a profession even?
Yeah. It's just one of those things where I feel like when you have something just constantly nagging at you, if you don't kind of follow your heart and soul, I kind of feel like that also leads to depression and stuff like that. So yeah. I really felt like it was calling me. Oh, I'm getting goosebumps right now as I talk about it. It basically felt like I had no choice, you know?
I mean, I know like when I am about to do something that I'm really, really love, and I'm really, really into it, I'm really, really interested about it, I have so much more energy and so much more like just life. I don't know. And then when I'm just like, what?
So you come alive in your element. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Then I'm like, oh, you're good.
Yeah, totally. I think I have, I don't know. I want to say, I think I have one of those personalities, but maybe everybody does. It's just fun to kind of follow the breadcrumbs and then just see where it goes. You know, like these ideas just constantly hit my head and they just annoy me until I, you know, kind of pursue it. So when I first got into herbalism, I was actually a dietitian aide at the hospital. I thought I was going to be a dietitian. I had this naive idea that I was going to be I was going to change the way that the hospital system feeds patients and stuff like that.
I.e. no more green Jell-O.
Yeah. Yes.
It sounds like, you know. Red Jell-O. Maybe that's better.
I don't know. Yeah. More antioxidants. Perhaps.
Yeah. Exactly.
I was a dietitian aide. And then Mountain Rose Herbs was in Pleasant Hill, Oregon. And then they moved to Eugene. And that's right when I was really becoming gung-ho about herbalism. I was like, you know what? I'm going to rethink my whole life. I'm just going to go see if I could get a job there, because I was living in Eugene. That's where I'm from. And sure enough, I got a job there. And then I saw a pamphlet for an herb school in the lunchroom. And then I'm like, oh, yeah, this is definitely what I'm doing. So it just kind of kept going that way.
So you saw the pamphlet for the herb school. So that really leads us into the next question, as what was your herbal education like? And tell us about the places and people you've studied with and apprenticed with.
Yeah, and I don't want to leave out KP Khalsa. Before I took the Columbine School of Botanical Studies, I was just kind of dipping my toe in the herbal world. And it might have been around the same time I started listening to a lot of Herb Mentor Radio, which is one of the earliest herbal podcasts that I could remember. And I just devoured that content, which was super fun because I felt like I got to know a lot of the herbalists, just like their tics and their specialties and stuff like that. But I ended up taking a 3-month course through Lane Community College in Eugene with KP Khalsa. And he would just go in depth on Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine. Fast forward, once I got a job at Mountain Rose Herbs, I saw a pamphlet for the Columbine School of Botanical Studies. And I was so into like adaptogens and stuff at the time. And I remember during my interview with Howie and Steven, I was like, are you going to teach about adaptogens, you know? And they're like, yeah, sure. You know, like I did not know what I was about to get myself into. And after taking that apprenticeship, it was a 2-year program, I started to realize that plants were a lot more than just cut and sifted dried herbs in an herb shop. I started to really develop relationships with plants in their natural environment. And that was just incredible, because the Columbine School of Botanical Studies, they almost don't promote it as like any sort of woo-woo or spiritual experience. It's very botany heavy and traditional Western herbalism. you'll find yourself, you know, after you're hanging out in the West Cascades and the old growth forest, looking at tiny little flowers through your loop and botanizing all day. And it kind of ends up becoming a spiritual experience just by default. So yeah, I took that to your apprenticeship. And then maybe, I don't know, a few years later, I started getting hungry to take another apprenticeship. So I ended up taking the Arcto School of Botanical Medicine in Portland, Oregon. And that's with Missy Rose and Grady Proctor. I know Missy was a student of Michael Moore. Grady also took the Columbines School. So there's a kind of some similar elements between Columbines and Arcto School. I feel like Arctos might have had a little more medicine making. And I took that for about a year.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and describe how you got into herbalism. And why did you want to become an herbalist and be involved with these awesome plants?
Okay, great. Well, I'm just going to reiterate that my name is Sierra, and a lot of people get it wrong. So I like to just impress that every time I am able to. So it's Gaelic and two syllables. So if I am in Ireland, they say Kira, but my parents decided on Sierra, like the Goddess of Grain series, and I was called cereal in kindergarten a lot. Not appreciated back then. But now I know that that's where we get the word cereal is from. The
Greek series. Oh my god!
Yeah. So I appreciate it a little more. It's sort of come full circle. I guess I feel that I was really just sort of drawn to herbalism as soon as I can remember being alive. So I had a pretty unstable childhood, early childhood, and I feel that I was really blessed to always be around nature, however. I always had access to, most of the time, beautiful nature, if not just a little plot of earth. So I feel like being out of doors and being in nature really gave me that groundedness that I needed and wanted and was searching for, and also sort of a sense of place and friendship. I feel like I was sort of nurtured by Mother Nature and raised by Mother Nature in my early childhood a lot. So I think just being outdoors, I would pretend at a young age that I was, you know, an orphan lost in the woods and I had to eat the wild plants to survive. And then someone would find me and I would always have a little like hideout, like a little special space that was mine and I felt safe and that I sort of gave back to and was in relationship with. So, you know, and then someone would find me out there eventually and be like, don't eat that. And, you know, years later, I'd find out that all the things I intuitively gathered, I could have eaten.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's pretty cool.
That is cool.
So similarly in school, you know, I was diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis at age 2, juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And I was bullied a lot as a child. We didn't really use that word back then, but
that's what it was.
So similarly at school, you know, I opted out for hanging out with plants instead of people a lot of the time. So and just like looking for acorns that had ant eggs in them and just for being a little scientist. And, you know, looking back even throughout junior, middle school, and high school, like all the projects that we would do, I would sort of incorporate plants without really thinking about it or knowing that it was a passion of mine. But, you know, I think in middle school we had a medieval day and I made rose petal bread. And one of my classmates reminded me of that years later and I'd forgotten about it. In high school, we did a science experiment and I grew 2 plots of grass seed and was mean to one of them and kind to the other.
Wait, how are you mean to
with my words? So
with your words.
Yes, yeah.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And the one that I was kind to grew much better. So and that was, you know, years before I ever heard of Omoto or any sort of thing like that. So that was just a concept I had come up with as a teenager. for myself. And I lived with my aunt when I was 7 to 14. She really nurtured my love of nature, and we lived in a very nice, just outdoor place with a creek and a quarry, a soapstone quarry nearby. And so I would transplant plants from other parts of the woods into my hideout and catch fish and collect fiddleheads. And she was into French cuisine, so she had Yul Gibbon's book, Stalking the Wild Asparagus. And so she would cook the fiddleheads that I brought in for me. And she showed me this book when I was about 7. And, you know, I definitely couldn't read it at the time, but I just knew it had to be the absolute coolest thing ever, this book about how to eat wild plants. So, and back then that was one of the really, you know, there now there's a ton of books on wild animals, but that was really the pioneer one. So although she wasn't so nature oriented, she did have that, was able to foster that in me and share that appreciation with me. So I don't think that I ever, really knew what an herbalist was. So, you know, later as a teenager, a hippie teenager, I was into like being all natural. So I started making like my own floral infused oils for perfume instead of perfume. And, you know, then sort of start studying on my own the magical side of herbs. And then as a young adult, I started researching the treatments and medicines that I had been put on for my rheumatoid arthritis. Intuitively, as a young child, you know, I felt weird about the fact that I would be given the same treatment. I was always, you know, the 10-year-old in the room amongst like 60 and 70-year-olds. And it always seemed really strange in some part of me that I was getting the same treatments that they were. And so as a young adult, I started researching the side effects of the medicines I was given. I took a new medicine and broke out in hives like immediately. So I started paying more attention to that and then started researching the medicinal side of herbs on my own. And yeah, I don't think I ever wanted to really be an herbalist until I went to herb school and knew it was an option. I definitely at some point wanted to sort of be a witch in the woods. And
me too.
Yeah. I love the word witch. So I don't know how much I embrace that word, but I definitely wanted to be like the wise woman in the woods, you know, in, you know, sort of solitude, speaking to the animals and sort of, you know, having people like seek me out and ask me about plants and, you know, come to me out there. And I certainly did that as well. I used to run, or not run, but I used to facilitate, hold space for full moon circles for 10 years, full moon circles. And so we did a lot of that for a long time. And then, yeah, I went to herb school and then realized, like, oh, this is a thing I can do. Yeah, career path, actually.
The thing I've been doing my whole life is a thing.
Right. It's a thing. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I guess that's how I got into herbalism, the long story. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank everyone for joining us for this episode of Best of Volume 2. It's really hard for me to pick out the clips because there's so many good ones. I try to pick out ones that maybe I haven't made a clip that's on YouTube of, that's sort of a little more obscure. Yeah, so I want to thank you again for joining me. And you can find us on Instagram, you can find us on YouTube, you can find us on Spotify, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, and you can find us on Anchor. If you'd like to support the show, we have an Anchor donation. You can donate at $1, $5, or $10 a month, or you can rate us on Apple Podcasts, leave a comment. That would be awesome. that all helps the show and supports us and what we're doing. I have no idea what we're doing next. So hopefully we're going to come back with something awesome. I know we will. And I appreciate everyone for listening and following us. And yeah, I'll talk to you guys later. Bye.